This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
David Swanson joins me live in studio. His most recent book is Undoing the Imperial Presidency. And you have, we were just talking, you have a new book that is in the works that we should see here within the next few months. Can you give us a little preview of what you've been working on?
I haven't announced it anywhere yet, but it will be called War is a Lie, and it will be about all the general lies that have been used for millennia by various countries to take us into every single war that we've ever been taken into, and it'll be out in about a month.
Wow, that's fantastic. So, again, the guiding theme is the fact that the governments use lies to whip up a war fever and get people into war?
Absolutely. Everything we think about wars is a lie. The nature of the wars and how we get taken into them and how they get maintained and prolonged and continued and moved to the next country. And, you know, I have very intelligent people like Vincent Bugliosi, who prosecuted Charles Manson and wrote this book on prosecuting George Bush, who swear to me that up until George W. Bush, no American president had ever dared to say a false word about a war, you know. And I just want to sort of get rid of that idea that there was something odd about the Iraq war being a war based on lies. I mean, I think war based on lies is just long-winded. It's just a long-winded way of saying war. They are always based on lies, all of them.
Give us some other examples, because we're, you know, in grade school, we're raised to think that there are good wars, you know, and then there were wars that were just sort of, they're probably not great ideas, but, you know, in the beginning, there were good wars. I mean, you think of, Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin, we were bombed, we had to go in. Remember the Maine, the Spanish-American War, you know, our ships were bombed there, too, and we had to go in. And our fleet was bombed at Pearl Harbor. And, you know, we've always been sort of, at least with those wars, we've been attacked first before we got involved.
Well, which is why in the book I focus more on World War II and the so-called good wars than on the others. There's no point in telling people about Iraq and Afghanistan so much. And I don't take it war by war, which would be sort of an encyclopedia and endless and repetitive, but I go with the types of lies. So there's a chapter on the idea that wars are defensive for one thing, and there's many other chapters on other types of lies. And the problem is that if you go back and look, there was not a Gulf of Tonkin incident. There was just a pretense of a Gulf of Tonkin incident. If you go back and look at the Maine, it hasn't been definitively proven to every single expert that it was blown up from within as opposed to from without. That is, from an accident or something planted in the ship as opposed to a mine in the harbor. But that's the preponderance of the evidence. And it doesn't matter, because Spain said, hey, we think we should have a joint investigation, appeal to an independent third country or international body. We want to get to the bottom of this. And the United States said, no, we want to get to a war. And the idea that they were certain it was blown up from without and that Spain did it is as absurd as the idea that Bush was certain Iraq had all those weapons. And if we managed to someday find a weapon or two in Iraq, it wouldn't change the fact that Bush was simply lying, and it wouldn't change the fact that our government and our newspapers were lying about the Maine. The Pearl Harbor was not the United States. We've never been attacked in the United States. This was a colonial outpost. It was not a state. It was a place where we had overthrown the Queen on behalf of the sugar plantation owners, and where we knew damn well that they were about to attack us. In fact, we went out of our way to provoke it for years. And then we used it as a means of fighting a so-called defensive war, not only against Japan, but against Germany as well. You know, make some sense out of that. So this idea that wars must be okay because once in a while there's really a good one doesn't make any sense. But if you go and look at those good ones, they aren't so good.
We're talking with David Swanson. He's online at davidswanson.org. Honored to have him live in studio this hour to talk about a host of different political topics here on the eve of the midterm elections. How are those shaping up from where you sit?
Well, you know, I'm still on the other side of this enthusiasm gap, you know, and here today we got deep water drilling back, you know, that ought to gin up some enthusiasm. We could have some more oil spills. Foreclosures can move right ahead. Not a problem there. You know, that ought to really energize people. I mean, I don't understand what these people are doing to get us enthusiastic other than complaining to us that we're not enthusiastic. You know,
you mean the Democratic leaders?
The Democrats and the Democratic leadership in particular, in Congress as well as in the White House. I mean, Harry Reid wants a moratorium on foreclosures, but he just wants that as a suggestion to the president. The guy's in charge of the first branch of our government. If he wanted a moratorium on foreclosures, he could put the Senate in session and do it. It's not as if the House wouldn't do anything the Senate would do and more. No, he wants the president to do it, but the president doesn't want to do it.
We were talking with author Ted Rall, whom you know as well, yesterday, and he was saying that this is sort of clear evidence that there can be no change within the existing system, that, you know, even an Obama-type leader is completely cowed and made powerless by the Washington elite and major corporate interests, and there's no way that he can stand up and say, look, you got to stop kicking people out of their homes.
Well, he could. It's not a law of physics. I mean, there is a danger and there is an understanding of what happened to President Kennedy and the dangers that face presidents who step out of line.
And what do you mean by that? There is evidence of the danger of what happened to President Kennedy?
I mean that the insider military CIA elite killed him and killed him because he was insufficiently aggressive against Vietnam and Cuba and the Soviet Union and so forth. And I think that there's certainly an understanding, even short of risking assassination, that you risk all sorts of stonewalling and backstabbing if you don't go along with the insiders in the permanent bureaucracy.
The phone lines are open at 977-1070. We're going to take a break for local news and pick up this conversation right where we left off in just a few moments. We're talking with David Swanson. This is Charlottesville Right Now. David Swanson is live in studio. His most recent book is Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency. He's online at davidswanson.org. Now, I have to ask you right before we broke, so I've got to ask you about this, even though we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this.
Okay.
But you made reference to the assassination of President Kennedy as being a lesson learned for presidents who really tried to do their own thing and buck the system that exists in Washington. So I wanted to give you an opportunity just to flesh that out before we moved on.
Well, as you know, there are thousands of books on that topic and we can go on forever. And I certainly haven't read most of them. I one of the best that I have read was recently a publication by a guy named Jim Douglas called John F. Kennedy and the Unspeakable that made really, I think, an overwhelmingly documented case that Kennedy offended a clique of very powerful insiders in the Central Intelligence Agency, in the military, that took him out and offended them by his overtures for peace and disarmament toward the Soviet Union, by his refusals to do what they wanted in Cuba and in Vietnam and so forth, which is not to say that that Kennedy was a pacifist, or that Kennedy never was an extremely militaristic leader himself, but that he was moving in a direction that they found intolerable. And I think that he knew there is also a great deal of evidence that he knew the risks he was taking and that he consciously chose to take them. I think it's plausible to conclude that he is a martyr for peace. And we don't have a lot of those.
And that Oswald was CIA.
The evidence that Oswald was CIA has been in many books for many years, and I think is extremely well documented. And you know,
there's conventional wisdom, and you know, the Warren Commission is that he was just a kook.
Well, I'm not going to argue he wasn't a kook, but he was also a CIA employee for decades. I as perhaps there's some correlation there. I'm not going to go into that. But you know, I actually bring up a question in the book we were talking about of whether certain incidents have to provoke wars or not. There was a story of Bush telling Tony Blair, let's fly some U-2 planes low, painted with UN colors, get them shot at, and then we can start a war with Iraq. And it called to my mind the incidents with the Soviet Union shooting down our U-2 planes that didn't provoke a war. You know, we went through decades of Cold War with incidents that could have been used as excuses for war, avoiding war. And when the Soviet Union shot down that U-2 plane, a guy named Lee Harvey Oswald, who was an expert on that technology, had gone to the Soviet Union 6 months prior and told them all about it. And he comes
helped
back.
Helped them to learn to shoot down U-2 planes. Yes,
apparently. And he comes back and he's not questioned. He's not prosecuted. He's not hung. Paid a large sum of money. He's given a passport overnight. He's treated as an important person, and he's a person who it was known for decades and has been testified to by numerous sources was CIA.
We're talking with David Swanson. He's online at davidswanson.org. His most recent book is Daybreak, and the phone lines are open for you at 977-1070. What are your thoughts on this foreclosure? I don't know whether to call it a crisis or a crime. It appears that crimes have been committed. I mean, that's really the only way I can think about it. I mean, you have companies that have put people out of their homes and with no legal basis whatsoever. They don't even have a mortgage on the properties, and they have put people out of their homes with the power of the government behind them.
At least the government's failure thus far to step up sufficiently and do anything about it. You have multiple banks foreclosing on the same home as if they both own it. You have, as you said, a home that doesn't even have a mortgage, was bought with cash, and you have a foreclosure. You have this chaos because they've taken all these foreclosures and packaged them into these securities and sold them and resold them to the point where many of the banks don't even know for sure which homes they supposedly own or not. There's a website just in the past day or two that's been put up called wheresthenote.com that actually allows you to demand of your mortgage owner, whoever it may be, that they produce the note and prove they own the mortgage. As you know, it changes from who you thought owned your mortgage. They sell it. But if you can defend your home by demanding that they produce the note and they can't do it, so much the better. As far as I'm concerned, I think we need a moratorium immediately on foreclosures. And some of the banks are doing that voluntarily. This is, you know, if they condescend to do it, okay, but the government shouldn't get involved. You know, that's outrageous. Well, the state attorneys general are very much getting involved, and at least 40 of them tomorrow announcing legal proceedings. But where is the United States Justice Department? You know, could someone foreclose Eric Holder's home, please? And would he notice that then? I don't know, because I used to work with community groups with a group called Acorn in particular, fighting the predatory loans that they were pushing on people to drive them into foreclosure. I mean, it's been clear for decades that the primary goal is to drive people to foreclosure for all of the fees and all of the income that comes from the refinancing time and again, and then from taking the house and reselling it. You know, we shouldn't think any longer of banks, many of them, in terms of wanting the borrower to be able to repay the loan. But here we are, people who haven't been forced into foreclosure, who haven't been forced out of their homes, who are still living there, and people are breaking down their doors while they're in the home, scaring them to death, who have absolutely no legal right whatsoever.
We're talking with David Swanson. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. We were talking with Ted Rall yesterday about his new book, and he is really calling for a revolution. That conversation and then the news of the foreclosures brought to my mind Shays' Rebellion of 1786, which was a violent armed rebellion against a foreclosure crisis. You had all these Revolutionary War soldiers who were given IOUs by the new U.S. government. They weren't paid for their service in the Revolutionary War. Their farms were being taken. Every time the courts met, there were farmers losing their land and losing their homes. It was a foreclosure crisis of the 1780s, and you had all these people losing their homes and losing their property who felt like the system was completely stacked against them to benefit banks and a very wealthy few back in Boston in this case. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about this?
Which sort of reveals the weaknesses of the American Revolution, which was not too long before that and didn't do much for working people, in effect shifted who the elite were from British to American. And it's similar to the bonus army following World War One of the veterans who camped out in Washington and said, we want to be paid the bonuses we were promised. An action that was nonviolent on their part, but they were attacked by the U.S. military.
Was it Hoover that did that, right? Or is it? Hoover went after the bonus army in Washington because they were camped out all over Washington, right?
He did, and it was all the future hero generals of World War II who attacked them. McDouglas and Pershing and, you know, these people. And yet they probably got us the GI Bill following World War II in order to avoid that again. I mean, there's no question that Raleigh's right that we need a revolution. The question is, should it be violent? And he does not make a case for that at all. I mean, his book doesn't even consider the existence of nonviolent approaches to change in the world. He simply assumes you can do nothing or have people start shooting people. I mean, he wants New Yorkers to take guns and go down to Wall Street and start shooting people. And he predicts absolute Armageddon and disaster whether we do that or not.
That really is his thesis. We have to do it now because it's coming.
But that even once we do it, we'll have no control over it. It will probably result in something even worse than what we've got now. But maybe down the road we'll be okay. And yet he doesn't address the accomplishments of nonviolent revolutions in dozens of countries around the world. The civil rights movement in our own country, apartheid in South Africa, the collapse of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, the eviction of the British from India, the overthrow of dictators in El Salvador in 1944 and other countries through Central America through the decades. I mean, he just pretends that nothing has changed in our knowledge of how things get done since Shay's Rebellion. And I think that's crazy. And I think that that violence is much, much less a useful tool for us now than it was back then.
We're talking with David Swanson, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. It's 15 minutes in front of 5 o'clock. Greg is on Charlottesville right now. Greg, welcome to the program. Go right ahead, buddy.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
First of all, I'm going to have a couple comments and a question. You know, I've been buying property since I was 14 years old, and I'm not wealthy by any means. But to me, if you promise to borrow money and promise to pay it back and you don't pay it back, then whoever you hold a note with got a right to come in and take your property. That's just how it is. Otherwise, what is the point in the risk of a person lending you the money? Second, if you buy a piece of property, like I've been doing, I don't do anything without a lawyer looking at everything the bank's doing. And if I see something I don't like, I get the lawyer to exit out. And thirdly, my question to you is, you mean people are paying their mortgage regular and on time, and they're coming in foreclosed on the house? I don't see that as possible. They'd have to do that at gunpoint in my house. And then I'm going to sign off and let y'all take it from there.
Greg, thank you very much for the call. We got a line open at 977-1070. David?
Well, they are doing it at gunpoint, and they do not have any legal right to do it. And it is crazy, and it is unprecedented. And we have not seen this before recent years. We've seen it coming just in the past few years. But this is brand new, that people who are not being foreclosed on, who are not in foreclosure yet, who are perhaps a month or two late in their payments, but still legally are qualified to stay in that house, their doors are being kicked in. And people are throwing their furniture into
the
street.
And this is the whole point, is we haven't seen this in this country. This is something new.
This is brand new. And I think it is the predictable result of giving these corporations immunity from the rule of law. And when they get into trouble, well, for these sorts of fraudulent practices that are their own fault, we bail them out. We don't prosecute them for their crimes. We bail them out. And this encourages the same and more, so that, you know, they force people who, you know, not everybody can afford a lawyer. Not everybody is able to detect every fraudulent term in the endless pages of a mortgage, and people have been ripped off for decades and driven into foreclosure, and there's been largely no consequence for that. That encourages, I think, taking this next step and saying, well, even if we haven't got people into foreclosure, we'll just take their houses.
We're talking with David Swanson. To me, that is really the larger point here, and there's a new documentary I want to see called Inside Job that you were talking about how, if you're a suit on Wall Street and you make a certain amount of money, it's okay for you to not pay somebody back because we're going to take public money from me and you and we're going to give it to you so you can still make your billions in bonuses at Christmas time and make your own mortgage payment on your third home in the Hamptons. And that is precisely and exactly and factually what has happened, that these guys have run their companies into the ground. They have bankrupt them. And then they come with their handout to Washington and demanded public money to bail them out, to socialize the risk so that they have a safety net, so that they can still maintain the billions that they make. And yet when we even think about something like that that's similar for bailing out folks who are losing their homes, who've lost their jobs, the quote-unquote Main Street folks, me and you, when we even think about something like similar like that, it's like, oh, no. Oh, my God. No. It's all your fault. You're screwed because it's your fault, not because the system is set up against you. And yet, if you are a corporate CEO or one of the managers, you have every right to socialism in this country. You have absolutely every right. And oftentimes, it's folks on the right who perhaps unthinkingly sign on to that makes complete sense to them. And I don't mean to speak with a blanket statement there, and I apologize for doing so, but I guess you get the larger point that I'm after.
Well, you know, Congress members across the board said 90% and more of the phone calls, which presumably includes quite a breadth of the political spectrum, were against the Wall Street bailouts. I mean, this was immensely unpopular in this country. And you had a Congress member on the floor say that the Bush gang were threatening Congress members with martial law if they did not hurry up and ram this through. I mean, this is...
But the same people who will be against it and say, oh, yeah, I wasn't for that, are the same people who are going to go in November and vote for Republicans, who are more likely to do something like this than Democrats. They're both going to do it, let's admit it. But the Republicans are more likely to bail out Wall Street without even thinking about it. They're completely fine with corporate socialism. It mm-hmm. makes all the sense in the world to them. And yet any type of socialism that benefits anybody who makes under $200,000 a year is criminal. And it's communistic and it's the end of the world.
Yeah, I mean, there are Democrats in the House who will talk a different line, who will say there is a bigger picture than just the fact that you should responsibly pay back your loans, or why would anybody ever loan money, and look at what's actually been happening for decades in this country, rampant fraud and theft that's legal purely because it's large corporations doing it. That being said, the biggest recipients of cash from these large corporations, from Wall Street and the rest of them, are Democrats. Barack Obama leagues ahead of anybody else, and they are doing the same thing the Republicans would be doing. They just are talking a different line, and they're talking some minor steps. But you know, the biggest entity doing these foreclosures is the government, is the FHA and Fannie. And it, you know, there is not the will in Washington to actually do something dramatically different. So by all means, reject the nonsense of Republican ideology and candidates. Yeah. But
we need
something
more than that. Well, let me ask you
about that.
Let me ask you, we're talking with David Swanson, and we invite you to join this conversation at 977-1070. Let me ask you about that. The ideology that we are hearing, because we're hearing so much of it now on the radio and television here on the eve of these midterm elections. And we're hearing, of course, the same things that we've always heard our whole lives, that you have a Republican candidate who will stand up and say, I'm for small government and less spending. And yet time and time and time again, when these people are elected, you get the opposite. This is a fact. You get bigger government and more spending from either party. And yet the Republicans still brand themselves that way quite successfully. People still believe this.
They do. And they do because they hear it over and over again, whether or not it's true. And if you look at the entirety of the federal budget, you look at discretionary spending, over half of it is military. And you will be hard pressed to find Republicans. There are some who are willing to touch that at all. Most want it increased even more, infinitely increased. There doesn't seem to be a limit. And yet that is the single worst way to spend money in terms of the United States economy.
To grow the economy.
If you want to benefit the economy, if you want to produce jobs, you know, if you want to not have, you know, jobless stimulus, as I think we heard in an advertisement on this station, the worst thing to do is to put the money in the military. Even the right wing scheme of tax cuts produces more jobs than putting money in the military. But if you put money into education, into green energy, into infrastructure, into all sorts of other industries that actually don't have lots of other negative side effects, you get more jobs. And in several cases, you get much better paying jobs. You get twice as many jobs and significantly better paying in education than in the military for the same federal dollar.
We're talking with David Swanson. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. David is on Charlottesville right now. David, thank you for the call. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hey, guys. Yeah, I think the bigger point that I'd like to make with all the tangents you're talking about today is, until we have term limits for every elected office, whether it's local, state, or federal, especially at the federal level, we're going to continue to have all these shenanigans and doublespeaks. I mean, it's clear that there have been many a poor man that's gone to Washington, but there's never been a poor man that comes away from Washington. You give everybody 1 6-year term, and they're gone, and they can't run again. And I think until we get to that point, we're just kidding ourselves on whether we're voting for the right or the left. And that's all I wanted to say.
David, thank you. Thank you for the call, and it's an excellent point. What do you think about that?
Well, I share the sentiment behind it. You would get rid of lots of the current corrupt elected officials who are misrepresenting us. But I don't think it's the right approach. And I think where it's been tried in some states, it's been proven to make things worse or to not fix them. And I think that's because the corruption is the money. The corruption is the lack of freedom of the press and a decent communication system. The corruption is the parties that control the gerrymandering and the money and the rest of it. And if those corrupting forces all stay in place and you just replace one face with another face,
it doesn't matter who's there or how long they're there.
It won't do us any good. And what's happened is we've started to think of the public's opinion and the voting in the elections as yet another corrupting force. And I don't think so. I think you clean up the elections so that they actually represent the will of the people, and you treat that not as another corrupting force, but as the heart of our democracy, and you make those elected officials afraid of being voted out the next time. I think that's the only way we get control.
David Swanson, his most recent book is Daybreak, and he's online at davidswanson.org. David, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.